All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Reports. And in these last two segments, we are shifting our focus a little more back to the resource sectors. We are chatting again with Joe Mazumdar, editor of Exploration Insights. Now, Joe joined us just a few weeks ago to talk about what he was doing with his portfolio. We talked a little bit about M&A in the sector, and we did also get some initial comments from Joe on leverage from the gold stocks to the underlying gold price, or I guess I should say the lack of leverage that investors have seen even just this year. We look at this year, gold's up around 12% year to date, GDX up around 10%. And I know a lot of us holding some of the juniors, well, those haven't performed overly well, but they have rebounded at the end of the year. Now, Joe, you've done some more research on leverage, especially when it comes to the producing stocks here and why maybe they are not providing that sort of leverage that investors expect when we have seen a good gold price and even a rising gold price. Joe, what are a few things that stood out to you as to maybe why the gold stocks are being held back a little bit in terms of leverage?
Okay, yeah, thanks. After our discussion, I dug into this a little bit in more detail and, you know, did a little rant in the weekly letter. And some of that was based on social media. Like, usually social media is not a great place to spend a lot of your time, but there's some sometimes good discussions that come out of it. And a friend of mine, Ron Stewart, from Gold and Copper Consulting, he produces these decent graphs about, and I encourage anyone to follow him, about 5-year quarterly operating margins based on the gold price and the all-in sustaining costs that are reported by, you know, a number of producers, intermediate, junior, and major producers. And also another discussion in parallel by a European natural resource investor, Oliver Grohl, I think it is. And he was just looking at Newmont. And so I sort of combined the two whilst looking at your point that, hey, you know, gold price has not done so badly. Why have gold stocks that are producing, you know, not provide the leverage they tend to do? You know, one of them, you know, we've talked about this before, might be that, you know, most of the gold price rise was due to central banks and we didn't see a lot of institutional equity or that wanting gold exposure. And I think now we're on the cusp of that obviously changing if we have peaked at real rates. And so going into 2024, there's a real, you know, possibility that people will be looking at gold stocks again as an investment thesis for gaining more leverage to the gold price. And then the whole question became about leverage. And then in Ron Stewart's graphic, you know, from the first quarter of 2019 to the third quarter of 2023, you could show that the leverage, all in sustaining cost leverage, as gold price went from about 1250 to new peaks over 2000, and the gold price went up 60% over that time, the all-in sustaining costs went up about 40 to 45% from about, you know, whatever, $850 to $900 an ounce to, you know, about $1,250 per ounce. So that made the margin basically contract from a peak of 48% in, you know, the latter part of 2020. And it actually went down to 30% the end of 22. And it's been coming up, but still it's only 36%. Even though gold prices jumped. And so that was like, well, what's going on here? And so what I noticed this before when we had Pan American Silver in the portfolio, and I took it out because I saw their margin compression back in 2022. And we sold back in 2021, I believe. But I saw that compression happening. And so I stayed out of producers. And so when I started digging into, let's say, just use Newmont, the, you know, the biggest producer, this is pre-Newcrest, they're all in sustaining costs. And so from 2021 and previous to the end of 2022, Newmont was using a gold price for the reserves of about $1,200. And then it was just in 2023 that they increased it by $200 an ounce to $1,400. And what you could say is that they were thinking at the time when they produced a sensitivity when the gold price was 1200 in the reserves, they said that, okay, if we increase our gold price to our reserves using a gold price of 1400, we add a significant amount of reserves. So we're going to add about 13% more reserves. We're going to go from 92.8 million ounces to about 105 million ounces, they said. But then when we look at the actual results from that year, that $200 change in gold price got them from 92.8 million ounces to 96.1 million ounces. So, you know, a much more modest increase of 4%. And if you dig into the details even more, the 3.1 million ounces of that increase was basically increasing their ownership of Yanacocha. So if you take that out, you're basically flat, you know, 92.8 million ounces going to 93.1. But what happened to their all-in sustaining costs was, you know, increasing the gold price by $200 an ounce brought in a lot of low-grade material. And the biggest change you can see is in their ownership of 38.5% of Nevada Gold Mines. So you could see a tonnage increase of 12 to 13% and a drop in the grade of about 15%. And so, you know, that negatively impact their entire all-in sustaining costs because it's such a big a part of their reserves. It's about 20% of the reserve profile. And so that's something to look at when people are looking for leverage in 2024 is anybody changing their cutoff grade? So if we do see a change in cutoff grade, you know, we're all happy. Okay, that means that there's more ounces, but we got to know that, you know, those ounces are going to come at a higher cost. And so, you know, is the leverage actually going to get diluted? You know, on a positive note, the input costs, you know, might be flattening if inflation is flattening, but mining is still exposed to, you know, labor rates, diesel costs, obviously, and power. So those things we got to keep watching for. And then if the company you're looking for leverage from is in a capital cycle and building a project, then a lot of that free cash flow or operating cash flow, sorry, will be going into maybe development and investing cash flow. So even though we're bullish about, you know, a change in the gold price, you know, we might not get a 20% increase in gold price because it's not done that badly this year, but we want to get back to a 1.5 plus beta to the gold price, which we're not at right now. So hopefully we'll see that going forward. But I just want to make people aware of is if the gold price increase, you know, allows people to, you know, change their reserve prices, we'll see lower cutoff grades and we'll see more higher all-in sustaining cost ounces come in.
Yeah, Joe, I think that's such an interesting point to make because we're going to see kind of those games finagling the higher gold price with the lower cutoff, bringing in reserves that are maybe not as marginal as some of the best ounces that were already in production. And so it's we may not get that big margin expansion we're hoping for. And some of the largest companies, when you look at the massive reserves they're trying to juggle, but a lot of people would point to some of the small to mid-sized producers that maybe don't have as much change in reserves, but maybe just margin expansion from a rising gold price and moderating to lowering input costs. A lot of people look for those kind of subpar producers, Joe, where they think, hey, if we see a $100 or $200 increase in the price of gold or a $1 or $2 or $3 price of silver increase, then these margins can increase on a bigger percentage rate than the biggest producers. What's your thoughts on playing that angle, the beta from the smaller to medium-sized producers?
No, I think that, you know, we might be on the cusp of actually these companies offering leverage, but especially if they're not, you know, changing their cutoff grades, because I do think some of these input costs might be flat year on year into 2024. And, you know, we're all bullish about, you know, that the gold price will still stay positive. So I'm just sort of saying that if a company you're looking at for leverage, dig in a little bit into the details in terms of, you know, what their plans are for 2024. And if there is any discussion about maybe dropping their cutoff grades in certain mines, adding ounces, and that may be great on a on an ounce basis and a revenue basis, but just know that, you know, some of those ounces that'll be coming in, if the reason is that the cutoff grade has been lowered, won't be coming in with the same margin as those last ounces.
What about the current ounces that are being produced? What about some of these small guys that maybe aren't looking at increasing production, but they've been grinding along here, kind of churning through money? But if the gold price goes up a couple hundred dollars more, the silver price goes up a couple dollars more, then they'd actually be in the positive. Would that change your assessment or the market's assessment of these stocks?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at something like back in the day, we had Claude Resources, a marginal producer in Saskatchewan with a growth project that they couldn't afford to build, and they had debt on their balance sheet. And as they removed the debt and got that project up and running, they got taken over, but they provided, investors with 4 or 5 time return in a small period of time because of the leverage they had. The leverage cuts both ways, but the thing is that if you're very bullish on the gold price and then you're comfortable that the company's production profile is what it is and they're not looking at changing their cutoff grade and their margins right now are basically marginal, there's a good chance that they could increase exponentially if the gold price goes up and everything else stays just about the same or even maybe better with respect to the costs input.
Well, Joe, another wrinkle that we can throw on here is how did the share count get diluted over this time period? Because there are some companies that have continued to dilute for different reasons. Sometimes it was to make an acquisition. Sometimes it was to build a mine. Other times it was just a feature of the market and being in a bearish market. But a lot of people point to, even if margins are roughly the same as they were in other periods of time where the miners performed better, the dilution effect over time has also eaten into it. How do you balance the dilution out with maybe some of the growth profile that they did with that dilution by buying other companies, building projects?
Absolutely. I mean, so we are investors in the stock market, and so we don't own debt, we don't own a stream, we do not own a royalty. We're taking everything on a per share metric. And so if a company over the past year or two had to continually raise capital in the markets to, just keep the lights on with respect to their production or sustaining capital, then we'll see that sort of leverage decay. I mean, the leverage I'm talking about is mostly on a margin basis, but not on a per share basis. Does, the increase in the margin suddenly mean these guys are going to come back to the market and make a big private placement because now the markets are buoyant? I would absolutely expect that to happen in 2024, before the next field season, that if the market is more buoyant, then there'll be a lot of people heading to the capital markets. So that's something else to think about when you're looking for leverage on a per share basis, let's say.
So, Joe, to me, this is all sounding so asset specific here, especially when you look at what Newmont did, changing their reserve price and not bringing in that many more ounces, brings up the question that are we simply running out of tier one assets that make so much money that they can be company makers where we're dealing with kind of lower grade assets? And maybe they're just the higher grade assets are in tougher jurisdictions, but is the problem right now that maybe all the easy assets have been found or at least are already well known?
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is, you have these spectacular discoveries like, your snow lines in the Yukon, decent grade deposits that are being, discovered or developed in Guyana, Reunion Gold, that sort of stuff. But I mean, they're few and far between of these projects in good jurisdictions with decent margins and upfront capital costs that are not in the multi-billion dollars. Let's just say, because some people will just go for jurisdiction. So they'll take, the knock-in grade, they'll take the higher cost just to know that, they don't get expropriated or the tax stability agreement doesn't change. Or, the infrastructure is so horrible that, they pay a lot, for other things. It is getting more difficult, and the other problem is that a lot of the money spent in exploration, hasn't really found much. And because the market is short term, people like to drill those holes that they know they're going to get a good result in. And so we're not really doing a lot of grassroots stuff. And grassroots stuff is really what can be a game changing find these game changing assets that you're referring to, as opposed to drilling the same old hole. And I'll put a little bit of a caveat on the idea of jurisdictions or places like, you know, the Walker Lane Belt of Nevada, that, you know, that place was looked at, you know, trodden upon. But every place has these little wrinkles. And that wrinkle there was that there was a lot of land there that was basically not allowed to be staked because of the potential for the need for that land for the nuclear repository at Yucca Mountain. And when Yucca Mountain was taken off as a solution for depositing nuclear waste, that ground came free. Renaissance Gold, now Origin Royalties, staked that area, did a joint venture, an earning with Silicon, on the Silicon project with Anglo Gold. They've discovered, you know, in an area that has been trodden, you know, basically a blind low sulfidation epithermal deposit that, you know, they're comfortable has over 10 million ounces in it. So, I mean, that is definitely a tier one asset that has been discovered, being delineated, and potentially, you know, hopefully developed in the next few years in Nevada. So, I mean, it's not like we can't find these deposits. It's just that, you know, we need the more longer term money going into these grassroots plays. And the problem is that the majors don't always do a lot of grassroots exploration. The juniors who we expect to do the grassroots are at the vagrancies of the capital markets. And so, you know, if they don't get that funding for that next drill program, they're basically not going to be drilling a big program. And so it's harder to make those discoveries.
Well, Joe, when you bring up the Silicon deposit that Anglo Gold Ashanti has now, it does make me think of what they did there in the Walker Lane trend, where they bought Corvus for that little Linmus strip that had some of the same kind of mineralization. And they also bought the Sterling deposit that Coeur Mining had originally explored by Northern Empire before Coeur took them over. And they kind of consolidated that whole district. Do you think we'll see some of the larger companies start doing things like that, where they buy up their neighbors, where it becomes a true large regional stake here of all the properties, and where we see more M&A of closeology plays?
Yes, I think that if you find something and you're a major company with a lot of capital to deploy, deep pockets, let's say, the first thing you'd want to do is consolidate that district. You don't want little eyes where people own parts, because you never know where you want to put the processing facility. You don't know where you want to put the tailings dam. You don't know if there's more mineralization under that. So you always want everything around, and consolidation is the way to go. And so, and also water rights. You don't know where the best water spots are. There might be a place with a closed basin on somebody else's ground that you might buy them only for that. You might not even buy them for the resources. You just know you've got over 10 million ounces on your stuff. You just want to make sure that all this other stuff, and you might even be happier if it's dead. That way, you know that that's where all the facilities can go. So yeah, absolutely. When a major gets a hold of something, they definitely want everything around it.
So Joe, bringing this full circle, this whole topic was brought up really because we talked about how investors or sentiment was still low for gold stocks, even though, let's say, gold was at all-time highs or very close to all-time highs. And a lot of people have correlated it to these rising costs. So as we move forward here, and again, the gold price is still doing well, and costs, maybe they've stabilized a little bit. But again, looking back at what Newmont did, that is maybe a little cause for concern, where they just didn't bring in that many more ounces. Where do you see sentiment taking us if, let's just say, we are in an environment here where margins don't explode higher, but they do remain healthy?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that right now, the valuation suggests that, and that's all driven by negative sentiment. Just a change in sentiment will have a positive impact on these valuations, just knowing what we know right now, without a big change in gold price. It's just that the sentiment towards gold is much, much better. Now we got to say, well, now what do you do with that? You know, how do you add more value, you know, by controlling your costs, you know, showing growth, finding new discoveries by doing more exploration? That's really on the individual company. So that's how people will, even though we might have a beta environment where all boats go up, you know, we can always go back to the alpha environment And so those are some companies that you might want to look at that do operate and think about controlling costs, think about growth, and think about exploration as well. Those are definitely some companies you'd want in your portfolio.
All right, Joe, thank you very much for taking some time with us on this New Year's Eve edition of the KE Report Weekend Show. New Year's is coming at the end of this weekend. We hope you all have a great weekend, a great long weekend again. And, well, I think we're all looking forward to 2024 and some improvements, continued improvements in the markets, because we are definitely ending on a strong note. And then, well, it just needs that carryover. Joe, thank you very much again for your time. I hope you have a very happy new year. We'll be seeing you in Vancouver at the upcoming conferences and also having you back on later in the month.
Great. Thank you very much, guys, and happy new year.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.